Lecture 23, Northwestern University, Materials Science and Engineering 405, Physics of Solids, Professor Mark Persom, November 3rd, 2006.
Okay, let's get started. We're going to finish off phonons today, and then I'll give you at least a brief qualitative introduction to band structure, which is really the heart of solid-state physics. Before we do that, let's finish phonons. What we did last time is talk about thermal properties of phonons. This required developing the quantum theory of the harmonic crystal, recognizing that phonons are very similar to photons with a couple of subtle differences that we pointed out. We then realized that there's two branches in the phonon spectrum, and the dispersion relation is quite different in the two cases. For the optical phonons, the dispersion relation is relatively constant, and so Einstein utilized a delta function to describe that dispersion relation, and from that we derived an equation for the specific heat from the optical phonons. Importantly, we found that in the high temperature limit it approached the experimental value of 3n case of B, but in the low temperature limit the specific heat exponentially decayed to zero, and as a result the optical phonons are not the whole story, there has to be something else. And as a result, we then went to the acoustical phonon modes, and we began to develop the so-called Debye model. So let me just remind you of the salient points from that, and then we'll complete the analysis. The acoustical branch utilizes the so-called Debye model. And what Debye assumes is a couple of things. One is that the dispersion relation in the acoustical branch can be approximated as a linear dispersion relation. And we show that that was a good approximation in the limit of small k. Then we have to, of course, write down d sub n. D sub n we can now derive utilizing this dispersion relation. This dispersion relation is identical to that of a photon, except now we have the speed of sound as opposed to the speed of light. So we replace c with v in the d sub n we derive for photons. In addition, there's three modes as opposed to two possible polarizations. And as a result, we get a factor of 3 halves. And that allows us to just write down the following expression for d sub n, 3 times the volume capital V divided by 2 pi squared lowercase v, the speed of sound cubed, times omega squared d omega. And this, of course, implied that capital N sub n was 3 v omega squared d omega divided by 2 pi squared v cubed e to the h bar omega over kt minus 1. Okay, so that's one assumption in the Debye model. The second major assumption is that there's a finite number of oscillators present, and as a result, we no longer will integrate from 0 to infinity. There will be a finite number of available frequencies for the phonons, so therefore we have to define what the maximum frequency is. And Debye assumes that if you just integrate the density of states from 0 up to some maximum frequency, that will be equal to 3 times n, the total number of possible phonon modes. And so this is the second assumption, and we'll find that it's a reasonable one because it matches well with the experiment. So we're going to take this density of states, 3v, divided by 2 pi squared v cubed omega squared d omega, and integrate from 0 to omega sub d. This integral is, of course, trivial. It's just omega cubed divided by 3. Evaluate at the bounds of the integral. So it's equal to v, the volume, divided or times omega sub d cubed divided by 2 pi squared v cubed. And that will be equal to the total number of phonon modes, 3 times capital N, where n is the number of atoms in the lattice. This, of course, can be solved for omega sub d, and will allow us to define a so-called Debye cutoff frequency, which will be equal to v, this is lowercase v, speed of sound, times 6 pi squared n, lowercase n, which is capital N divided by v, the number of particles per unit volume, to the 1/3 power. So this is the Debye cutoff frequency. So that's the second important point. So if you wanted to rederive this problem in some reduced dimensionality or higher dimensionality space, obviously d sub n would change, and that would imply that omega sub d would change, and that's where you'd start the analysis. The homework problem will be something along this line. Okay. We then have to write down what the energy density is, lowercase u. That is, of course, the total energy divided by volume. So we're going to multiply by 1 over v. And now integrate from 0 to omega sub d as opposed to 0 to infinity as we did for photons. We'll take the occupation number and multiply it by h bar omega, h bar omega being the energy of a particular phonon mode with frequency omega. This is times the occupation number, which we just derived. So we'll put in all those terms. In the denominator, we have 2 pi squared lowercase v cubed e to the h bar omega over kt minus 1. And again, fortunately, the volume cancels, and that will normally be the case in solid-state physics. The volume will become a normalization factor. Most properties we'll be talking about are not dependent upon the size of the solid. At this point, you could attempt to evaluate this integral, which is not straightforward. And what is typically done in the analysis is to take the temperature derivative now. So what we're after is not u, but the specific heat, C sub v, which is partial u with respect to temperature. And we did the math last time when we just write down the result. It's equal to 3 h bar squared divided by 2 pi squared v cubed, k sub b, t squared, integral 0 to omega sub d, omega to the fourth, e to the h bar omega over kt divided by e to the h bar omega over kt minus 1 quantity squared d omega. And I made some comment like, doesn't look like we're getting anywhere with this analysis, but there's one last trick we have to employ which will reveal the t to the third dependence that we're seeking. And in particular, what we'll do is define a new variable, x, which is equal to h bar omega over kt, which of course implies that omega is kt x over h bar, and d omega is equal to kt over h bar dx. When we do this change of variables, we of course have to change the bounds of the integral as well, and so there'll be some new upper bound x sub d, which will be h bar omega sub d over kt, which I'm now going to define a new variable, theta sub d, the Debye temperature, where theta sub d is equal to h bar omega sub d divided by k sub b. Okay, and what's important to recognize here is that when we do this substitution, we're going to get 4 values of t, or t to the fourth from this omega to the fourth, and then a fifth factor of t from d omega. So we're going to get a t to the fifth in the numerator, which will be divided by t squared and give us the t to the third dependence that we're seeking. The only complicating factor, though, is that the bound of the integral will still be temperature dependent. So it's not obvious yet in what limit the t to the third dependence is valid. So that's what we'll complete today. We should do a couple more manipulations before we go on. One of those manipulations is to recognize that theta sub d is equal to h bar omega sub d over kb. Oops, sorry. Theta sub d is equal to h bar omega sub d over kb. But we derived an expression for omega sub d, so we can plug that in for theta sub d. It's equal to h bar v divided by k sub b times 6 pi squared n to the 1/3 power. And as a result, this implies that k sub b over hv quantity cubed is equal to 6 pi squared n divided by theta sub d cubed. Why that's important is when we now calculate C sub V, we're going to find that this term will emerge. So let's go ahead and do that. We'll plug in these change of variables into C sub V and then simplify. We'll come back to this relationship in 1 minute. So let's do that. going back to C sub V, we see that it's equal to 3 h bar squared divided by 2 pi squared v cubed k sub b t squared. Now putting in our change of variables, we're going to get 5 factors of kt over h bar. So that will be raised to the 5th power times an integral from 0 to x sub d of x to the 4th e to the x over e to the x minus 1 quantity squared dx. And now we can see when we do this manipulation and collect terms that the prefactor in front of this integral will be equal to 3 k sub b divided by 2 pi squared k sub b over hv cubed times t cubed integral 0 to x sub d of x to the 4th e to the x divided by e to the x minus 1 quantity squared dx. And now this becomes very convenient because we've derived an expression for k sub b over hv to the 3rd, so we can just substitute that into this equation. We'll notice that the pi squareds will cancel, and what we'll get out is that c sub v is equal to 9 k sub b lowercase n t divided by theta sub d cubed integral 0 to x sub d x to the 4th e to the x divided by e to the x minus 1 quantity squared dx. And this would be true for all temperatures. All you'd have to do is plug in temperature. Temperature will tell you what x sub d is, and this is a definite integral at that point. So you can execute that definite integral. You have to do it computationally. And so again, while this is the complete correct answer, it's not very intuitive. It's hard to really understand how this function behaves in the limiting cases of high and low temperature. And so like we'll normally do in this course, to ensure that this is a reasonable result, we'll consider those limiting cases. Before I do that, is everybody comfortable with how I got to this point? Okay. So let's try the two limiting cases. First, the high temperature limit. So if T is much, much greater than theta sub D, X sub D is theta sub D divided by T, and as a result, this implies that X sub D is approaching zero, and as a result, e to the x will be small and can be Taylor series expanded as 1 plus x, and of course there'd be higher order terms. Now, in the numerator of the integral, this is just e to the x, and as a result, we only have to keep the zeroth order term. Whereas in the denominator, because this is e to the x minus 1, we have to keep the first order term, which is x. And as a result, c sub v in its limit will be equal to 9 k sub b n times t divided by theta sub d quantity cubed integral 0 to x sub d. The numerator, we say now in this limit, is just x to the 4th, whereas the denominator is going to be 1 plus x minus 1 squared, which is just x squared. So x to the 4th divided by x squared is x squared, and the integral of x squared is x cubed divided by 3. That will be evaluated from 0 to x sub d, and as a result, this is equal to 3 k sub b n times t divided by theta sub d quantity cubed times x sub d cubed. Remember, x sub d is just theta sub d divided by t, and so this is equal to 3 k sub b n times t divided by theta sub d cubed times theta sub d over t cubed. These two terms cancel, and we find that in the high temperature limit, the specific heat of the acoustical phonon modes is also equal to 3n k sub b. This is, of course, what we were seeking. So this is as expected. So what this tells us is that for both the optical and the acoustical phonon modes, in the limit of high temperature, the specific heat will become equal to some constant, which is 3n k sub b. That makes sense. If you think about a very hot crystal, you're exciting lots of phonon modes. There's lots of vibrations. And as a result, there will be both acoustical and optical phonon modes present. And they both better lead to the same specific heat. Otherwise, we'd have some discrepancy between theory and experiment. So this is a nice result. Just looking at this equation, I don't think it was obvious that that was in fact the result, but we see now that it is. Okay. The other limiting case is the low temperature limit. And I'll write it down in a minute, but I think you can see what's going to happen. In the low temperature limit, theta sub d divided by t is going to become very large. And as a result, that integral, instead of being from 0 to some value x sub d, will become an integral from 0 to infinity. An integral from 0 to infinity, of course, has no temperature dependence. It's just a number, and so you can evaluate it. And as it turns out, there is an analytical solution to that definite integral. And it'll give you some constant. When you multiply that constant by the remaining terms out in front of the integral, you'll find that the only temperature dependence is t cubed. And so we can see, without actually doing the math, that this is going to work out. But let's go ahead and write it down, just to be sure. Okay. So for the low temperature limit, that is temperature much less than theta sub d, that implies that x sub d becomes temperature independent and equal to infinity. And as a result, the specific heat is just 9 k sub b n times t divided by theta sub d cubed integral 0 to infinity x to the fourth e to the x divided by e to the x minus 1 quantity squared dx. And this is just a definite integral. It's equal to some number. And you could look it up or derive it if you prefer. And it's equal to 4 pi to the fourth divided by 15. So we just simply simplify this equation and find that the specific heat in the low temperature limit from the acoustical phonon modes is 12 pi to the fourth divided by 5 k sub b n times t divided by theta sub d cubed. And so we finally solved the problem that we faced, well, I guess now a week ago, which was posed to us by free electron theory. The fact that the specific heat of a metal in the limit of low temperature had two terms, one which was proportional to t, which came from free electron theory and resulted from the electrons, but there was a second term which went as t cubed, which we could not find from free electron theory, and it results from the acoustical phonon modes. Okay. So the bottom line is that the Debye model leads to C sub V proportional to T cubed in the low temperature limit, which is in agreement with experiment. So we did it. Okay. Now, are there any questions on the thermal properties of phonons? Yes.
The Debye cutoff limit, is that the maximum frequency that the atoms can be excited to?
Yeah, that's the highest frequency phonon mode which could be excited. That's what it would represent physically. Okay. I should point out that's an approximation. Because phonons are bosons, you could imagine that you could have all 3n phonon modes just exciting the lowest frequency. That would be possible, I suppose. But probably unlikely to be the case, especially as you turn on temperature. It's likely to have higher levels excited. And so that's the assumption that's made here, that they sequentially fill up like you'd have for fermions following Pauli exclusion principle. We only know that that is a reasonable approximation when we see the result here. There's nothing that we did to prove that that should be the case. It was an assumption of the model. Other questions on phonons? Okay. That really concludes the discussion. I want to make a couple other points, though, which are relevant. These are other comments on phonons. If we had infinite time, we could do these in more detail, but I just want to point them out to you. So other notes to make. One important note is that phonons effectively act as if they have a momentum P, which you could approximate as h bar times k, This is often referred to as the crystal momentum. This is an important point, because whenever you have a multi-particle interaction in a solid, where you have a momentum conservation problem, you always turn to the phonons. Because the phonons have a relatively large momentum and a relatively small energy. So your energy conservation typically is not thrown out of whack by phonons, because they don't contribute that much energy. But they do carry a lot of momentum. So whenever you have some transition where you have a momentum conservation problem, phonons will bail you out. So that's an important point. For example, we'll learn about indirect bandgap semiconductors at the end of the course. We'll find that the indirect bandgap semiconductor, if you have a transition from the conduction band to the valence band, you're going to have two problems, an energy conservation problem and a momentum conservation problem. Photons can't save you because photons carry very little momentum. And as a result, the only way for that transition to occur efficiently is via phonons. And so electron hole recombination events in silicon, for example, which is an indirect bandgap semiconductor, will be mediated by phonons. Whereas in gallium arsenide, which is a direct bandgap semiconductor, we will not have a momentum conservation problem. And as a result, photons can also carry the energy away. And so direct bandgap semiconductors like gallium arsenide will be very effective light emitters, whereas silicon will not be. So that's the point I'm making here. Second note is that anharmonic crystal interactions by this, I mean the real potential energy is not just proportional to x squared, which is what we've assumed thus far. We've assumed a harmonic model. But there'll be higher order terms, some constant g times x cubed, some constant f times x to the fourth. And there could be even higher order terms. These higher order terms, the x cubed, x to the fourth, etc., are important and lead to the theories of many things, probably most importantly, the theory of thermal expansion, and if you're interested, Cattell gives you a very hand-wavy explanation of thermal expansion, but you may want to read that to get a sense of what it's about. Ashcroft and Merman does it a little bit more rigorously. These anharmonic terms lead to corrections to the elastic constants. For example, the elastic constants will have a pressure-dependent term, which will result from these anharmonic terms. Also, probably most significantly, multi-phonon interactions can be very beautifully explained with these anharmonic terms. Again, it's a relatively subtle point. We don't have that much time, so I'm not going to do it in detail in this class, but I want to make you aware of it in case in your later research multiphonon interactions become important. This is where you should go back to. Okay. Any final questions or concerns about phonons? Okay. So if you look at the syllabus, we're supposed to move on at this point past phonons, and in particular, all that we've really explained thus far about solids are thermal properties. And of course, if you think about a solid, probably when you think about the electrons in the solid, you think of them transporting charge, that is leading to the electrical properties or the conductivity of a solid. And we've done nothing to address that question yet. And we really can't address that question until we acknowledge another drawback of free electron theory. And that is, in free electron theory, we assume the potential that the electron sees is zero inside of the solid. But of course, there are the ionic cores of all the atoms, which are present at every position in the lattice, every few angstroms. And it's going to imply that the potential that the electron sees is not zero, but a periodic potential. And the question is, what does that effectively infinite periodic potential imply for the behavior of the electrons? And so that's really what the next week or so will be about, is addressing that fundamental question. We're going to find that it's going to explain why the conductivity of a material can vary by as much as 10 to the 32nd. If you think about the highest conductivity metals, they'll have conductivities, or I should say resistivities, which are on the order of 10 to the minus 10 ohm centimeters, whereas the most effective insulators will have resistivities on the order of 10 to the 22 ohm centimeters. So there's this 10 to the 30 second difference between a good insulator and a good conductor. And we've done nothing so far to explain the difference between those two. So that's the objective here, to describe the behavior of the electrons in the periodic potential of the crystal lattice. And this is often referred to as the theory of nearly free electrons. We'll find that the electrons in a solid are almost free, but just slightly not free. And those subtle differences will imply 10 to the 32nd differences in conductivity from material to material. So it's an important but subtle difference. And I'd like to begin the analysis with a quote. This is a quote out of Cattell by a guy by the name of Bloch. And he says this: "When I started to think about it, I felt that the main problem was to explain how the electrons could sneak by all the ions in a metal. By straightforward Fourier analysis, I found to my delight that the wave differed from the plane wave of free electrons only by a periodic modulation. And it's that periodic modulation that's going to lead to these very subtle differences in the energy versus K, or the omega versus K relationship for electrons in a solid. Those subtle differences will imply these dramatic differences in the electrical properties of materials." So that's what we're going to attempt to understand. And I'm going to take you through this in many different perspectives, and we'll find that no matter how we slice the problem, the result will be that there will be some energies in a solid which are no longer allowed, so-called band gaps, that will open up. And there will also be energies which are allowed. And what we'll find is that at the edges of those allowed bands, the slope of the EK relationship will go to zero. And that slope going to zero is going to make all the difference in the electrical properties of solids. So that's where we're going today. So let's talk about nearly free electrons. Okay. So the point is that the weak periodic potential in crystals leads to subtle but important modifications to the free electron model. Remember, the free electron solution of the Schrodinger equation was the first solution we did. And I told you it would come back to us, and this is where it comes back. We'll find that it's almost the same. And the important result from free electron theory is that the electrons which are free are plane waves, right? They have a form of e to the ikx plus or minus omega t. So they're propagating to the left or to the right. Because they're plane waves, if a plane wave sees a periodic potential, there'll be the possibility of Bragg reflection occurring, which is something that most material scientists are comfortable with from the theory of X-rays. It's the exact same thing here. Instead of having a photon that is an electromagnetic wave, we'll have an electron, which will also have a wave-like nature to it. And as a result, for critical values of K, it will undergo Bragg reflection. Okay. So before we get to that, let's first write down a picture of what I'm talking about. So what we're going to do is first consider periodic crystal potential qualitatively in one dimension. And this will be a very qualitative argument that we do today. And we'll find that this will basically capture all the physics there is regarding band structure. Of course, you can spend a whole PhD calculating band structures, and people would do that if they were in Art Freeman's group, for example, in the physics department. It's not a trivial problem to do a real band structure for a real material. If you think about it, what we have is not a simple periodic potential, but often there'll be more than one atom present. For example, if you had sodium chloride, you'd have sodium and chlorine, or if you had gallium arsenide, there'd be gallium and arsenic. So you have two different potentials. In addition, you're going to have a three-dimensional system, and each crystallographic direction you look along, there'll be a different periodicity that's present. In addition, you're going to have many electrons, which possibly could be promoted into the conduction band, and so the band structure can become very complex. Despite that, this analysis we'll do today will capture most of the poignant physics. So let's consider this qualitatively. We're going to model a solid simply as a line of atoms. And we're going to assume that these atoms promote some electron into some delocalized conduction band. That electron, which is now free to move throughout the solid, is going to see a potential energy, which is periodic, and will look something like this. Why does the potential energy look like this? Well, the atoms have liberated an electron. As a result, they're now positively charged. They're going to have an attractive Coulomb potential, and that's what's being indicated here. So there's an attractive Coulomb potential at every point in the lattice. That's what the electron would see. So these points here represent the ion cores, and the spacing would be some one-dimensional lattice constant A. And this would represent the only dimension we have, which is x. Okay. Now, as I just said, we're assuming these electrons are nearly free. If they were perfectly free, we know that a free electron is described quantum mechanically as a plane wave. And of course, it's a little more complicated. It's actually a wave packet, as we know, with ill-defined position and momentum. But it's basically a plane wave. And because it's a plane wave and we have a periodic potential, this plane wave will undergo Bragg reflection. When k is equal to plus or minus n pi over a, where n is any positive integer. This is a basic result that you find in, say, material science 201, at least in our department. Okay. Very common notion for material scientists thinking about how x-rays interact with matter. And if you recall, what happens at the Bragg condition . This propagating wave will no longer propagate. It would be reflected in the case of an X-ray, because you're bringing it in from free space, hitting it against this periodic potential, and it gets reflected. Here, the electron just exists in the periodic potential, and still be some component of the wave which will be scattered back. And these components, which are going to the left and going to the right, will perfectly balance one another and set up a so-called standing wave. So propagating wave solutions at the Bragg condition are no longer permitted. And as a result, we will generate a standing wave. So any of you have taken a course from Professor Bezik would have heard about X-ray standing waves. It's the same notion. But we're talking about some sort of electron standing wave. But it's not all the electrons. It's just the electrons which have a value of k, which is equal to n pi over a. So it tells you that something interesting is going to happen at values equal to pi over a, 2 pi over a, etc. If you recall from the dispersion relation for phonons, we also found that pi over a was an interesting point and led to the formation of a frequency gap. Here we're going to find that at pi over a, that is the first Brillouin zone boundary, we'll have the origin or generation of an energy band gap. So let's see how that works. we generate a standing wave. So let's consider one particular case. Let's try the case of k equal to pi over a. So that'd be n equal to 1. If you have k equal to pi over a, and we say that this wave is, say, going from left to right and scattered back from right to left, then we're going to have components which go as e to the I kx, where k is pi over a, in terms which go as e to the minus I kx propagating in the other direction, where again k is pi over a. And so if you want to generate a standing wave, there's actually two ways to do it. So there are two ways to form a standing wave from oppositely propagating traveling wave solutions. Okay, so let's think about it. One way to do it, I'm going to call psi. Now we're talking about wave functions again. Psi for plus, so I'm just labeling as plus. That would be if we had e to the I pi x over a plus e to the negative I pi x over a. From Euler's formula, we know that this is just equal to 2 cosine pi x over a. And that's exactly what we were seeking, something which is not a propagating wave, but a stationary standing wave, a cosine or a sine function. The other way to construct a standing wave is to take the difference of these two terms. So I'm going to label that psi minus, following the notation of Cattell, which would be e to the I pi x over a minus e to the minus I pi x over a. And of course, using Euler's formula, we can immediately see that this is equal to 2i sine pi x over a. Of course, in quantum mechanics, the wave function itself has no real physical meaning. It's the magnitude squared of the wave function that will tell us where the charge is located. And so the electron charge density will have two possibilities. One which I'm going to call rho plus, which will be proportional to the magnitude squared of psi plus. Magnitude squared of cosine, of course, is proportional to cosine squared pi x over a. Whereas rho minus, which will be proportional to psi minus squared, will be proportional to sine squared pi x over a. So there's two possible standing waves that can be set up. And what we want to do is analyze the energy of the electron in those two cases. Are they going to be the same or different? If there's a difference, that would imply that there will be a splitting of the possible energies of the electron at the Brillouin zone boundary, and therefore the generation of an energy band gap. And so let's plot these two functions and compare it to the positions of the nuclei in the lattice. Okay. So the top curve A is what I tried to sketch on the board. It's showing the potential energy as a function of position for this one-dimensional periodic lattice. What's plotted below that is the probability density, rho, and there's two cases, psi plus and psi minus. Psi plus, Cattell is shaded in, so that's this solution here. And what you'll notice is that for psi plus, the electrons are concentrated directly over the nuclei. And as a result, in that case, their energy will be low, right? When the electrons are sitting over the nuclei, that's a very nice situation for the electrons to be in. They'll minimize their energy. They want to be over the positively charged ionic cores. So that's going to be a reduction in energy compared to the free electron. The free electron is not localized anywhere. It's completely delocalized in space. And so it would have a higher energy than the case of psi plus. On the other hand, psi minus, we see that the electrons are now exactly localized away from the ionic cores. In fact, they have zero probability of sitting directly over the ionic core. They want to sit directly between the ions. And that's the least favorable possible position for the electrons to be in. And as a result, psi minus that standing wave solution is going to lead to an increase in energy compared to not only psi plus, but also compared to the free electron solution. And so it implies that the Brillouin zone boundary, that we're going to have a splitting of the energies, one which is less than the free electron solution, one which is greater than the free electron solution. That is, a band gap will open up in the solid. Does everybody follow the argument here? Okay. If you get this, then you get it. I mean, that's all there is to it. We're just going to spend the next week doing this mathematically. But I like to start here because it's really easy to get caught up in the details of the math and lose sight of how simple the theory really is. Just to drive this point home, let's write down what I've just said. Question.
So this is only for the electrons with those specific moments of
it. Exactly. It's only for the electrons at the Brillouin zone boundary, or at k equals 2 pi over a, 3 pi over a, 4 pi over a. Everywhere else, the electron behaves as if it's completely free. And so free electron theory is pretty accurate. It's describing everything except those particular points in the EK relationship. And so that's why free electron theory did pretty well and does explain a lot of things reasonably well. It's just anything which happens near these Brillouin zone boundaries, or the so-called band edges, are going to be very different than a free electron. As it turns out, in particular in semiconductors, the band edges are where all the action is. And so free electron theory does a very poor job of describing semiconductors and insulators. In fact, according to free electron theory, every material which we could possibly make and that it would exist would be a conductor. And we know that is not the case. So it's the non-conductors that the deviations from free electron theory are most important. So, what we just saw from the figure is that rho plus implies that the electrons have maxima over the ions, which implies low energy. Whereas rho minus had minima over the ions, which would be high energy. Like I said, this is extremely qualitative. I'm not telling you anything about how much, you know, is it half an electron volt, 10 electron volts, a milli electron volt. I'm just saying it's some increase in energy. And that's, of course, where we have to do the math to figure out exactly what the band gap would be in a particular material. But the point is, qualitatively, what this implies is that Bragg reflection implies the opening of an energy gap at these critical values of k, which are plus or minus n pi over a. And so we can try to sketch what's happening here, or I can try to sketch it, test my artistic ability. So we're plotting an EK relationship. Let's first plot an EK relationship for a free electron. Remember, the EK relationship was h bar squared k squared over 2m, so it's just a parabola. Okay. So I'm going to call this the free electron locus of points, where E we know is h bar squared k squared over 2m. What we know is that while that is still true for values of k away from pi over a, at pi over a and minus pi over a, now we're going to have one case where the energy is less and one case where the energy is greater than the free electron locus. And as a result, the band structure will now have the following shape to it. Okay. And it's subtle, but there are two important differences here. One is we now see the opening of a forbidden energy gap. So that's clearly different from free electron theory. Free electron theory, all energies are available. So that's an important difference. And the more subtle difference are these slight deviations here. These slight deviations here are going to make all the difference in the electrical properties of materials, and we'll come back to that. For now, I'm just pointing them out to you. Most importantly, we see that the slope of the EK relationship, it goes to zero at the band edges, whereas in free electron theory, the slope is not zero anywhere. Remember, the slope of the EK relationship is directly related to the group velocity. Okay, so that's going to tell you that if you have electrons right at a band edge, they're not going to be able to conduct. They're going to have no velocity, no group velocity. They will not move through the solid. So that's an important point. What else can we see from this diagram? In addition to forbidden energy gaps, there are allowed bands. So we could call this the first allowed band. Call this the second allowed band. And of course, we could go on and on. Well, when we reach 2 pi over a, another band gap would open, 3 pi over a, etc. And so there will be multiple band gaps and multiple bands in all solids. And that's a misnomer. Many people think there's just one band gap. As it turns out, there's one which is most relevant. So for silicon, there's this band gap of 1.1 eV, which is the most relevant. There's no doubt about that. But there would be other band gaps. They just don't contribute significantly to the properties of silicon. So does everybody accept this picture? The last point I'll make, and then we'll be done for today, is to recognize that because there's a periodicity in the lattice, there's also a periodicity in k-space, just like we were arguing was the case for phonons. And as a result, all of these relationships that I've just written down, these EK relationships are periodic in k, and we'll have a period of 2 pi over a. And as a result, we can fold everything back into the first Brillouin zone by taking things which are 2 pi over a away and folding them back to 0, and vice versa, shifting everything by values of 2 pi over a, or any integer value of 2 pi over a. So a couple of notes. As I just said, there'll be other energy gaps. And they will occur for integer multiples pi over a in k space. And secondly, since the lattice is periodic, the reciprocal lattice, that is k space, is also periodic. And as a result, k plus 2 pi over a is effectively equivalent to k. And as a result, it will imply that the EK diagram can be collapsed to the first Brillouin zone. And this is often called the reduced zone scheme. And essentially every paper you'll ever pick up in Physical Review Letters or whatever your favorite journal is that shows a band structure will show you just the first Brillouin zone. Because it tells you everything. And so what these band diagrams will look like in one dimension, instead of what I just had drawn there, would look something like this, where all you look at is between minus pi over a and pi over a. And they'll have a shape like this. So we already saw that one. The second one we now need to fold back. We need to move it by 2 pi over a. And as a result, this point here will move to that point there. And so you can see that it's going to have some shape which looks like this. And then the third one will, of course, look like that. And you can go on and on. Okay. So, of course, these regions are band gaps. These are the allowed bands. And this diagram, the EK diagram, will be called the band structure. And that's what the next week will be, is calculating band structures. We're going to find that no matter how we slice the problem, it's going to look something like this. In most materials, you're going to find that the relevant band gap will be at a position here, like this, where the band directly below the band gap is going to be concave down, and the one directly above is going to be concave up. Why is this relevant? So what we're going to do is approximate at the band edge. This is a quadratic relationship. It's just like a free electron. The only difference is that the concavity of this could be different than the concavity of a free electron, due to the presence of the lattice and the potential of the lattice. What it means, though, is that if we now define a new mass, a so-called effective mass, dictated by the concavity of the EK relationship, then we can take all the results that we derived from free electron theory. And so that's all we're going to do, is we're going to say, okay, we'll take the second derivative of this, relate that back to some new effective mass, and then simply apply free electron theory. And remember, from free electron theory, what we found is that the group velocity of the wave packet obeyed the classical equations of motion. And as a result, electrons in a solid are going to behave very much like classical entities, except with some new mass, the effective mass. We'll reduce all the quantum mechanics that we've spent 8 weeks developing into one number, the effective mass, and then forget about it. Okay? It's that simple for many properties. Of course, there are exceptions which are more interesting, but that'll explain most of the important properties of conduction in a solid. One thing I want to point out, though, is that if you look at the valence, well, I haven't defined this yet as a valence band, but I'm going to call it a valence band now, the first band below the important band gap. The valence band has the opposite concavity, and as a result, it would imply a negative effective mass. And that's a completely accurate way to think about it, but it's hard to conceptualize a negative effective mass, and so we're going to employ a trick which will invert the mass, but when we invert the mass, we're also going to have to invert the charge. So we're going to think of the carriers in the valence band not as negatively charged particles with negative mass, but rather as positively charged particles with positive mass. We'll call them holes, and they'll obviously move in the opposite direction as the electrons in an applied electric field. We'll come back to that point next week. So if there are no final questions, have a good weekend.
MSE 405.